called celiac disease. Mm-hmm. But I maintain that it would be better off for everybody not to indulge in anything that has gluten in it, because it's eventually going to flatten out the villi in your small intestine, like Dr. Cohen said. And it's like a pasty type of a substance. So I would recommend going with less starchy foods. Also, one of the things I learned on a local cable access show called Nature's Ways, the local doctor was taking a hiatus that month, and it was on the first Sunday of the month on Channel 11, local cable access, and they had a couple of hippie-looking doctors come down from the Puget Sound area, and they were had quite an interesting show. There was mostly talking about raw foods, and they even said things like, you know, stay away from even things like beans if you can avoid them, because they're just basically starch, and starch just gets converted to fat, and it's even though they have lots of fiber. And then another thing I learned on the Health Watch with Dr. David Neiman was he had a lady on there one time, I can't remember, I think she was a doctor, and she was talking about how bad soy products were for you. And I know that canola oil, canola and soy oil, soybean oil are both toxic in separate ways. But I would also recommend, and I don't have any dog in this fight at all, but I wish we could grow our own industrial hemp here in Oregon.
I hear you completely, Joe, and thanks a lot. We do have another caller. And I actually think when it comes to industrial hemp, I think if we had been growing that the whole time, that we would have more newspapers right now. But I'm just putting that out. Thanks a lot, Joe. Joe is a fountain of information. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. We are starting to get to the end of our show. I'm your host, Lisa. Our guest is Dwayne Ratliff. He is the creator of an iPhone application and database about food label information called Don't Eat That. And we do have another caller. Dennis, what's going on, Dennis?
Hey, good morning, Lisa. How are you doing today?
Great. How are you doing?
Dwayne, I wanted to tell you that me and my wife had just seen our first I can't remember what the product was, but it said contains no high fructose corn syrup, and it was like New Year's Day, man, to actually see that, because we knew that Alpenrose, which is a local dairy, they really battled, they ran into some problems because they wanted to put a label on their milks that said no bovine growth hormone, contains no bovine growth hormones, and they, like, all the other dairies in the nation really started, like, slamming them. But I think they got that passed through. And one more thing I wanted to ask you, because I missed the beginning of the show. You sound like just a guy I'd see on a street walking around. What was the first step that clicked in your head that said, man, I can do this. I can really step up and make something happen here. What was that, man? Because you sound like a real normal, outstanding personality, man. So I'll take that answer off the air, and thanks for all your work.
Thanks a lot, Dennis. Dwayne, what made you realize you could do it?
I didn't know I could do it at first. It was kind of gradual. If someone told me what I had to do at the beginning, I wouldn't have done it because it was too much work. But it was sort of gradual, and then I became fascinated about getting rid of bad information, and a side of that is like how wrong the internet is often. I mean, that really shocked me. You know, I'm the type of person, I know my weakness is like when I hear something that I want to believe, I kind of stick with that. So I had to actually work against that. I said, all right, I'm not going to stop until I hear something I don't want to see, so I can have something to compare. And that was what I used to build up the database. The other thing that is interesting, and what I hope this app really does, is to encourage people to pressure the FDA to be more consumer-friendly. I want the FDA to put stuff on. I don't want some dairy. The FDA is to protect us, not corporate America. And I really want to get that out there. America needs to get on board with that. I'm really hoping this app jumpstarts. Yes, because I have like 1,800 ingredients. There's things on that the FDA doesn't even allow you to put on, like contact ingredients. You know what your food comes into contact. They don't even put that on labels. Mm. You know, like what was that one out of bisphenol A? That's not listed anywhere.
Mm, but it's in your food.
Yeah, because it's in it comes in contact. I really hope this will mobilize people to do that. That is really my goal. I would really love to see that happen.
Okay, cool. Dwayne, we have one more caller.
Okay.
Gary's on the phone. Gary, what's going on? Quickly.
Hey, good morning. I have a suggestion that would kind of solve the gluten problem. I'm a hunter, and so I kill deer and elk. And we started eating deer and elk, and I tell you, just cured all the gluten problems and kind of just covered it all up and took the problem away. So I just want to know what you think about that.
Thanks a lot, Gary. You know, I have actually heard that before, and that goes back to that idea of the Paleolithic diet that,
yeah.
I think maybe Scott was talking about that. Thanks a lot. And my daughter loves meat, you know. Okay. But, Dwayne, so we're running out of show. Final comments. What's the most important thing that people should know about your iPhone application and your database called Don't Eat That? What's the most important thing people should know about their food?
That it's constantly changing and it's being improved all the time. And actually, it's really simple. You know, for being an Apple application, it doesn't have all the bells and whistles, because I don't want it to be entertaining. I don't want people to be confused that it's entertaining. It's informative. It's extremely informative, and I want people to use it. And I'm encouraging anyone who uses it to send me a private email about any new information they know, because I want improvement. If I have any erroneous information, please let me know, because this is a work in progress. I really want it to develop into something that we can all use every day.
And your website is don'teatthat.com.
No, .org.
.org. Don't
and .info, because I had both, because I didn't know what I was doing.
Okay, don'teatthat.org. And Dwayne Ratliff, I just really want to thank you for being with us today. You really sparked a fantastic conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And watch out for that dyes in your kids' cereal. So this has been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm Lisa Loving. Thanks for tuning in, and stay tuned to KBOO.
KBOO's annual book and record sale happens Saturday, August 28th, 2010. So now is the time to clean out your closets and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for your community radio station. Bring them by KBOO during regular business hours. We are located at 20 Southeast 8th, just a half block south of Burnside. Or contact Ani to make arrangements for a pickup. Reach her by phone at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or email volunteer@kboo.org. We are accepting donations of books, records, CDs, DVDs, and VHS tapes through Tuesday, August 24th, 2010. Then be sure to come to the sale, being held at Musicians Union Local 99 at 325 Northeast 20th on Saturday, August 28th, 2010.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up next at 9 o'clock on Political Perspectives, host Marianne Barasonic speaks with Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal, a story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal. Coming up next at 9 o'clock.
Jerry Van Dyke, author and journalist, has a new book, Captive, My Time as a Prisoner of the Taliban. A searing account of being a hostage or a fraud from a former frontman for U.S. intelligence. You be the judge. Tune in to A Deeper Look this Thursday, July 22nd at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO. And join me, Linda Olsen-Osterlin, for my conversation with Jerry Van Dyke.
Good morning. You're listening to Political Perspectives. I'm Marianne Barasonic. Nick Bryant has been looking into the plight of poor children in America for over a decade. He started out writing articles for magazines like the Journal of Social Distress and Homelessness and the Journal of School Health. But as he started looking into child trafficking in America, he stumbled onto a pedophilia ring that went to the highest levels in the government. It's all in his book, The Franklin Scandal. Nick, thanks for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to be on the show.
I'm thinking about how to approach this story because it's kind of a long, complicated one. And I thought maybe we could start with the story of Shaunita Moore. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who she is and what happened to her?
Well, Shaunita Moore was one of the initial victims to come forward. And she said that she had been involved in a child prostitution and pornography ring starting at about the age of 9. And she came forward after another girl named Eulise Washington came forward. And she said that she had been flown around the country starting at the age of 14. And both the girls came from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. Shaunita had a very difficult childhood in that her mother had a lot of problems and she was single. And Eulise was in a very abusive foster home where she had been molested as like a 9 or a 10-year-old. And then her foster parents ultimately pandered her out to this interstate pedophile network that flew around.
Okay, so maybe you can kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of what the Franklin Scandal is.
Well, the Franklin Scandal gets its name from the Franklin Credit Union, which was a credit union in Omaha, Nebraska, that provided loans to lower socioeconomic people in North Omaha. And the Franklin Credit Union was ultimately busted out for $40 million. And because it was a small local credit union, it was only supposed to have about $2.5 million in it. So,
when you say busted out for $40 million, what do you mean?
There was approximately $40 million embezzled from the Franklin Credit Union.
Oh, okay. So this tremendous amount of money was embezzled from a bank that shouldn't have even had that much money.
Yes, and it hadn't been audited in 4 years. And federally insured credit unions have to be audited every 4 years. So, this was in Omaha, Nebraska, and a Nebraska State Senate subcommittee started to investigate the embezzlement because they felt like something had really gone awry here, because this credit union shouldn't have had $40 million and it should have been audited yearly. So as they started to investigate the credit union, social services employees came to the senators and said, there's something much more sinister than just financial crimes here. We've had reports that Lawrence E. King, who ran the credit union, was operating an interstate pedophile network that flew children from coast to coast and pandered them to the rich and powerful. And Eulise Washington and Shaunita Moore were the first two victims to come forward. Eulise came forward in 86, and Shaunita came forward in 88, at least documented-wise. And the social services employees had tried to get federal and state law enforcement to investigate this pedophile network, but they were simply ignored. So then the state senators decided to start investigating this pedophile network. And that's when they hired an investigator who found additional victims. So ultimately, six victims came forward, and they were threatened and coerced by the FBI.
Okay. Let's go to the investigator that the state senators in Nebraska hired, Gary Caradore.
Yes, he was an amazing investigator. And as soon as he got on the case, he started to take tremendous amounts of heat from the FBI. His phones were tapped. And I know that this sounds very implausible and bizarre, but my book is replete with documentation pertaining to everything that I'm saying. And he started finding victims, and he ultimately videotaped four victims. And their testimonies, he ended up with like 26 hours of videotape testimony. And their testimonies repeatedly corroborated each other on perpetrators, events, interstate flights. And they were very, their accounts were very similar to the accounts of Ulysse Washington and Shanetta Moore.
And these were people who didn't really know each other, so that the fact that their details matched was really telling.
Well, they knew each other because they were all enmeshed in this pedophile network. Well, at least the four that Gary Caradore interviewed kind of knew each other. A couple of them knew each other fairly well, but they were geographically segregated. I mean, two of them were in prison, and two of them were still out on the streets. So, and they hadn't had any contact before Gary Caradore talked to them.
Because ultimately, wasn't the way that it was presented in the media was that they had kind of cooked up this whole conspiracy. But in your book, you kind of go into why that really isn't very probable.
Well, once these videotapes, once Gary Caradore had the 25 hours of videotape testimony, the senators showed it to ranking members in the judiciary, the Nebraska judiciary, and also the federal judiciary. And the toothpaste had come out of the tube. The feds and also state law enforcement could no longer say that the allegations didn't add up or weren't substantial. And a couple of grand juries were formed because of that grand jury testimony. There was a state grand jury and a federal grand jury. And both grand juries concluded that there was absolutely no child abuse, and it was simply witch hunt hysteria. But I have the sealed testimony from one of the grand juries, and in my book I show exactly how that particular grand jury was hijacked. But the grand jury essentially said that these drug-addled kids came up with this huge conspiracy that was reported in the New York Times and also throughout various media in the United States, and certainly heavily reported in Nebraska. And it's very funny, the grand jury report that said that these drug-addled kids concocted this this hoax, it didn't name the hoaxers. I mean, it was a very bizarre report. But ultimately, what the feds were covering up and what the state judiciary was covering up was, and I go into this in my book, and this too sounds implausible and bizarre, but I feel like I prove it in my book, is that a lot of these kids were flown to Washington, D.C., and they were pandered to very affluent individuals and people within the government. And in Washington, D.C., where a lot of these pedophilic parties occurred, there was a house that was wired for audiovisual blackmail. And I believe, and I make a pretty strong case for it in my book, that the grand juries in Nebraska and also the grand jury in Washington, D.C. that covered this up, I make a pretty strong case that there was a grand jury in D.C. that covered it up, too. They were protecting the names of a lot of these politicians.
How did you get the sealed grand jury testimony?
Well, that's kind of a complex story, and I really can't get into the specifics of that, but I will say that I cultivated enough trust with enough people over the years where they felt that they could give me the sealed grand jury documentation and testimony, and I wouldn't, if I was brought before a judge, I wouldn't disclose their names.
Okay.
I would take the fifth.
So let's go back to Gary Caradore. You had said that he presented enough information that people had to start taking this seriously, but then the FBI started stalling the investigation. What did the FBI do?
The FBI started threatening and harassing victims and also perpetrators. In my book, I have testimony from the kids that recanted. The FBI came in and was really brutal to the kids. I mean, they put the kids in a vice, and most of the kids collapsed like a house of cards because they had relatively low self-esteem. I mean, they'd been turned on to drugs at a very young age and repeatedly molested at a very young age. So when the FBI came in, and a lot of these kids just, I mean, they stuck to their guns for a short period of time, and then they just caved into FBI threats and intimidations. I mean, the FBI said, if you continue with this story, you're going to go to prison for perjury. And they were very definitive about that. And actually, there was a millionaire perpetrator who wanted to come forward, according to an affidavit I possess. And he was seeking immunity from the state so he wouldn't be prosecuted for his crimes. And he would give up some of the perpetrators in the pedophile network. And I have an affidavit from a state senator that says that the FBI threatened to kill him if he talked to anybody affiliated with the Senate subcommittee.
You're listening to Political Perspectives. I'm Marianne Barisonic, and my guest is Nick Bryant. We're talking about his book, The Franklin Scandal. Well, Nick, so the FBI came in and they threatened the victims with perjury charges if they continued to insist that their accounts of abuse were true.
Yes.
And then they threatened to kill the perpetrator who
Kill a perpetrator who wanted immunity from the state subcommittee investigating the child abuse allegations.
Right. And then Gary Caradore had an unfortunate accident, didn't he?
Yes. Gary Caradore was a great investigator, and he found four of the kids. And, I mean, he was really going against the current. I mean, we're talking against Whitewater type current. He... his phones were tapped. He was followed. The FBI repeatedly harassed him, and then the FBI had told one of the victims that if you say that Gary Caradore ran an investigative agency, and he had a stellar career as both a law enforcement officer and as a private investigator. And one of the victims was told by FBI agents that if you say that Gary Caradore concocted scripts and gave you cash, we'll completely we'll let you out of prison. We'll drop, I mean, all your legal problems will be dropped. And Gary Caradore realized that he had to come up with very definitive information. I mean, although there were six victims that came forward and repeatedly corroborated each other, Gary Caradore felt like he needed to come up with pictures. And when I was first cutting my teeth on the story, I interviewed a photographer who was part of the blackmail side of this. And he told me that he had met Gary Caradore in Chicago and gave him blackmail pictures. Now, this individual has been busted for child pornography, and he isn't the paragon of veracity. So it's difficult to take his word at face value. But I have, in my book, I discuss Gary Caradore. I have four other corroborations that Gary Caradore came by pictures in Chicago, just not from the blackmail photographer, but from four other sources. And so I think it's pretty obvious that Gary Caradore came by blackmail pictures of kids and adults of this particular pedophile network. And he was flying back to Nebraska. And his plane mysteriously broke up over Lee County, Illinois. And if you read my book, you'll see that it's quite a necropolis. I mean, every chapter there are two or three people either committing suicide or dying very mysteriously. In addition to co-opted grand juries and FBI intimidation, and in Washington, D.C., Secret Service intimidation, There were also a number of deaths affiliated with the story.
Now, there's a small Oregon connection here in your book. Rusty Nelson was the photographer that you were just talking about.
Is yes.
That, yeah. And he kind of was traveling through Oregon and got pulled over. His van got searched, and they found pornographic pictures. And these are pictures that could have validated some of the children's stories. In your book, you state that the pictures were destroyed. Who destroyed them?
I believe the state of Oregon did.
Because they were in the custody of state of Oregon authorities and then they just mysteriously disappeared?
That's what I gather. I was pursuing so many leads, but there was an attorney who represented Rusty Nelson throughout that, and I talked to the attorney, and he said that that's what happened. So I went with his story, and I did not pursue that particular angle of the book. I mean, when you read the book is the amount of research that went into the book is kind of mind-boggling. I worked on it for 7 years, and I traveled 40,000 miles. And so that little Nebraska snippet kind of withered on the vine for me. I couldn't...
You mean Oregon?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the book is fascinating because there's so much detail here. Ultimately, what happened? Now, I mean, when we started talking about this, the reason that it started coming to light was because of Lawrence King, who was heading up the bank that had far more money than it should have had.
Yes, that was embezzled for $40 million, even though it should have only had $2.5 million in it.
So where's Lawrence King now, and what happened with him? Because supposedly he was the person who was running a lot of the children around to D.C.
Yes. Well, the gentleman, Lawrence King was a GOP power broker. He sang the national anthem at the 1984 Republican Convention and held a big bash at the 1988 Republican Convention. But the person in Washington, D.C. that set up the parties was also a Republican power broker. His name was Craig Spence. And he was the person who had the house that was wired for audiovisual blackmail. And according to Spence and other sources in my book, he was a CIA asset. And Craig Spence is just one of the many suicides in the Franklin scandal. He eventually, when this started breaking open, Craig Spence commits suicide.
So what about Lawrence King? What happened to him?
Lawrence King did 9 years and 9 months for financial crimes, and he is currently out and about.
But he's no longer politically connected?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay, so one of the people who came forward to testify on videotape for Gary Caradore was Alicia Owen. And yep. Can you, what happened with Alicia?
Alicia is really a testament to human courage. Alicia got mixed up in the pedophile network as an adolescent, and she was flown around to various locations, and when the FBI came calling, after she had given her testimony to Gary Caradore, the FBI came calling and tried to intimidate her into recanting her abuse, and she refused to. And she was at the age of 21, she was indicted by the federal grand jury and by the state grand jury. Each indicted her on 8 counts of perjury. So she was looking at, I think, 160 years from the state indictments and around that much time for the federal indictments. So she was looking at like 300 years in prison. And she still refused to recant her abuse. She said, "I was abused, and I'm not going to recant, and regardless of what happens to me." So she went through a kangaroo court, and in my book, I really get into her trial and just how heavily corrupt and perfidious her trial was, and how she was basically a slaughtered lamb. There was a lot of jury manipulation, and I mean, the whole host, there's just like a whole bouquet of malfeasance in her trial. But anyway, the upshot was she was found guilty of perjury And she was sentenced to, and we're talking a kid now, she was sentenced between 9 and 15 years for perjury. And she did about two, they put her in solitary for for about 2 years.
Which seems like a really harsh punishment for what, you know, given what her crime supposedly was. And what would have been her motivation to come up with a story like this?
Well, the insane explanation was is that she was seeking riches via movie and book deals.
But there never was a movie or a book deal.
No, and she never talked to any reporters. So actually, I'm the first journalist that she ever talked to. So the state's contentions were extremely bizarre. And
now, did you
motivation?
Did you talk to any of the people who prosecuted Alicia?
They did not want to talk to me. So I did talk to some of the people that testified against her. And one said that he was lying, and a couple just refused to talk to me too much. So, but
now the one who said that he was lying, did he say why he was lying?
He said threats from the FBI.
So it looks like this may have been the FBI cooperating with the CIA.
It's entirely possible that I have the Department of Justice, the Secret Service, and the FBI nailed as far as covering this pedophile network up. And I make a pretty strong case that the pedophile network was CIA connected. So, yes, it could be a case where the FBI is covering up for the CIA. And in the book, I have another example of that happening, where some people called the Finders were reportedly trafficking children, and they were busted by the feds, and the CIA ultimately quashed the investigation into their seemingly very sinister activities with children. So yes, it's likely that that's the case.
Okay, this is Political Perspective.
Or I should say it's possible that that's the case.
Right. This is Political Perspectives. My guest is Nick Bryant. We're talking about his book, The Franklin Scandal. Now, the motivation for the CIA to have set this whole thing up would be that once they had the pictures of various political figures with children, then they have control over them.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Is there any... So this was never... these particular children are all adults now. Has there been any indication that this was stopped?
Well, the thing about it is, they were never stopped. In the book, I talk about the Finders, but I really get into the Nebraska network or the Franklin network, and there's no indication that whoever was perpetrating these crimes was ever stopped. I mean, they were both in both instances I talk about. The perpetrators were let off scot-free. And also there is, depending upon what study you look at, there are 100,000 to 300,000 American children that are trafficked domestically every year.
See, now, to me, it's incomprehensible that that many children would be trafficked. Like, we recently had a boy disappear from his school here in Portland, and it's been the subject of this extensive ad campaign and a manhunt. And every once in a while, I'll look at the, the missing children ads and stuff. And these are, for the most part, children who are obviously in custody disputes, because you look at the ad and it's, last seen with, and it's obviously a parent. So how is it possible that that many children are being trafficked like this?
I think a lot of kids fall through the cracks. There's a lot of runaways, and at least in the Franklin network, kids were taken out of foster care, and that was a relatively small percentage. They were taken out of orphanages. That was, a larger percentage. And a lot of the kids were simply runaways that had fallen through the cracks from dysfunctional homes, and they were scooped up and provided with drugs and a place to stay, and in turn they had to perform sexually. And I think that that is probably the case with a lot of the kids that are involved. There's very few stranger abductions in the United States. According to the federal government, there's somewhere between 300 and 400 a year. But there are tens of thousands of children that fall through the cracks and become unaccounted for. And I think that a large percentage of those children are most likely trafficked. But the problem is, so you've got like these tens of thousands of children being trafficked in the United States, but there's never, ever an interstate pedophile network that gets busted. I mean, it's always someone that lives in like a trailer court smoking crack with a couple of 14-year-olds that gets busted for trafficking. So if those numbers are in fact true, there's obviously some very refined, well-placed pedophile networks in the United States that are operating and seem to be operating with impunity because, there, as I said before, there, the Franklin scandal, as far as I know, is the only book that really proves the existence of an interstate transcontinental pedophile network in the United States where the kids were actually flown to various locations from the East Coast to the West Coast and everywhere in between.
Now, Gary Caradore started getting close to being able to prove this, and he had a mysterious plane accident. Have you had any problems?
I had a death threat on my first trip to Nebraska, and I experienced some extreme harassment a couple of times too. Once my car, my rental car, was pulled over, and I guess I had committed the egregious crime of going 70 in a 65. And I was deposited in a state trooper cruiser, and my car was completely ripped apart, and all my possessions. So, and there's been some other strange stuff that's happened to me over the years, too. But the way I kind of looked at it is it was just so evil. I mean, what I'd come across was so evil that that all these kids, I believe that this pedophile network was in existence for approximately a decade and had destroyed the souls of so many children. And then it was immaculately covered up by state and federal law enforcement, and the media went along with state and federal law enforcement. So I've written a lot about children's issues, and I'm very sensitive in that area. So I just felt like it was so evil that I just had to do something about it. I had to write a really definitive book, and I put the bar very high as far as the proof that I needed, because the allegations I was making were just so shocking and plausible.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us. My guest today has been Nick Bryant. We've been talking about his book, The Franklin Scandal. Thanks again, Nick.
Thank you.
KBOO is proud to support PDX Bridge Festival, July 23rd through August 7th. 2 weeks of arts and culture celebrating the bridges that connect us all. PDX Bridge Festival's Brunch on the Bridge, Saturday, August 7th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Experience the Hawthorne Bridge in a whole new way, transformed into a temporary park with thousands of square feet of lawn, food carts, picnic tables, and music. Ticketing is required. For more information, visit pdxbridgefestival.org/brunch. Smiling upon the
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is now 9:30. Coming up next, we'll hear about the origins and techniques of modern propaganda from the World War I to the present. Guests include Mark Crispin Miller.
Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe.
This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to discuss the art of government propaganda. To help us understand it, we're very pleased to have as our special guest, Mark Crispin Miller, Professor of Culture and Communications at New York University. Professor Miller is the author of numerous books, including Cruel and Unusual, Bush-Cheney's New World Order, and Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election. He wrote the introduction to the recently republished classic Propaganda by Edward Bernays and is featured in the documentary films Stealing America, Vote by Vote, about the 2004 presidential election, and Orwell Rolls in His Grave, about corporate control of media. Professor Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to start with a quote from MIT professor Noam Chomsky, and I'd like your comments on it. He wrote in Media Control, "Propaganda is to democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state." What are your thoughts on that?
There's a lot of truth in that. Propaganda is the main means whereby the state, in an ostensible democracy, has its way with the people. This has really been the case for the last 100 years or so, most notably since World War I. You've got to master public opinion in order to do what you want to do. And the way to do that is to use propaganda.
One of the most important propagandists of the last century, Joseph Goebbels, said, in propaganda, truth should be used as frequently as possible.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Joseph Goebbels was, you know, Hitler's minister of propaganda. He's the example that most often comes to mind when we talk about state propaganda at its most sinister and lurid. But he had his counterpart, he has had various counterparts in the West, even though American propaganda hasn't been as spectacular as Nazi propaganda. I think you could easily argue that the American government has relied as extensively on propaganda, especially over the last 10 years or so, as the Nazis did. Goebbels said a lot of quite brilliant things about propaganda. He noticed, for example, that the most effective propaganda is the kind that calls the least attention to itself. When you know you're being approached by a propagandist, when you know you're being addressed by someone with an ulterior motive, you're on your guard. Whereas if the propaganda seems almost as it were part of a natural environment, it's like the very air we breathe, and we don't quite notice it, we don't focus on it, it's all the more effective for that, because our guard is down. You know, now Goebbels would point to various kinds of film, public spectacle, torchlight parades, things like that. But we have, in the commercial sphere, product placement and stealth marketing and all sorts of other covert methods that, in their own way, are just as cynical and just as effective as the stuff the Nazis came up with. Goebbels was right about the use of the truth. Whenever possible, propaganda must be factually accurate.
Now, Hitler said the great masses of the people will more easily fall victims to a big lie than to a small lie. Why is that?
Well, that's a very famous theory of the big lies based on the assumption that people will be less inclined to doubt or resist an enormous lie precisely because it's hard to believe that anyone would tell a lie that big. And I think that's a perception that's extremely pertinent to the moment we're living in now.
Now, when we talk about propaganda in America, one of the intellectuals we have to talk about is Walter Lippmann, who wrote the book Public Opinion, published in 1922.
Right.
And he coined a term, the manufacture of consent.
Right.
What was Lippmann's thesis?
He had such a dark view of public reason that he believed that it was essential for the survival of democracy that there be a kind of caste of experts who are above politics and who would have the wisdom, to be blunt about it, to keep the people fooled, to direct public opinion in beneficial ways, manufacture consent, in short. This first became quite clear with the successful enterprise of the First World War. I mean, when we talk about propaganda, as we have been doing today, we tend to go immediately to the sort of grotesque and magnetic example of Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis. But the fact is that modern propaganda, whether it's commercial or political, had its roots not in fascist Europe, but in England and America in the 19th century. Modern propaganda and advertising is simply a sphere of propaganda, were both basically Anglo-American creations, the late 19th century. The rise of this new science of propaganda, if we want to call it a science, coincided with the new interest in applied psychology for political effect. And one of the things that Lippmann understood the propagandist must do is to find the ways in which one might move people at an irrational level. Lippmann understood very, very keenly that the collective mind, the mind of the mob, if you want to call it that, is not a reasoning mind. It's not logical. That people en masse tend to be irrational. Now, I think that Lippmann takes this further than necessary. I think that his distrust of democracy is ultimately quite dangerous. But he makes a very compelling case in public opinion. Let's return to the example of the First World War.
Right.
Here we had a conflict of unprecedented violence that had to be sold to populations that had no particular reason to want to go to war at all. The Americans and the British were really disinclined to get involved in another war. How does one basically sell a conflict like this to people when the interests being served, in fact, are not the interests of the public? You know, it was basically an obscure imperialist rivalry.
So that's when the Creel Commission comes in.
That's right. When we're talking about the United States.
Yes.
Woodrow Wilson appointed George Creel to be the head of the Committee on Public Information, which basically had the job of selling the war to the average American. And the obverse of this, of course, the necessary obverse of all propaganda is censorship. So the committee's job was twofold. It was, first of all, to sanitize the war and make sure that its true horror didn't register at home, and also to come up with a number of very stirring, purely emotional stimuli that would get people on board. What they did was they represented the Germans as Huns. They sort of rehabilitated this old Asiatic threat and very cleverly identified the Germans with the Huns of yesteryear and represented the whole conflict as a battle between barbarism and civilization. The British were the most prolific in coming up with atrocity stories that actually bore no relation to reality whatsoever. The Prussians were indeed quite brutal, but they didn't do any of the things they were accused of doing. They didn't crucify Allied soldiers. They didn't cut the breasts off of nurses and bat them back and forth with their butts of their rifles. They didn't impale babies on bayonets. The particular commission that came up with these stories had on it a number of very famous fiction writers and poets, people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, this is the guy, you know, his Sherlock Holmes stories are beloved the world over. This guy really knows how to tell a story. People like him and like H.G. Wells and others were working for the government in a kind of literary capacity to invent these atrocity tales that would make the war almost irresistible.
Did they know the material for the stories weren't true?
I think at the very highest levels they had to know.
Do you think that the writers knew, or were they just fed
It's very hard. That's the most interesting question about propaganda across the board, is the extent to which those who engage in it are themselves convinced of it. The fact is that 10 years after the war's conclusion, a very important book came out called Lies in Wartime. It was written by Lord Ponsonby, who was a socialist member of Parliament. It was a short but very effective, very meticulous analysis of all the most notorious atrocity tales that had been used throughout the propaganda drive to get people on board. Ponsonby demonstrates in every case that the story was false, was made up. And this is something a lot of people had suspected, but Ponsonby let enough time go by that people were ready to hear the truth, and the book was an enormous bestseller both here and in Britain, and it did a tremendous amount to enlighten, some might say disillusion people, about what the truth really was. The reaction after it became clear that the governments of Britain and the U.S. had really basically fooled people on a grand scale. The reaction was quite devastating. It was an enormous wave of anger and sort of cynicism. The lesson here is that, and then this is where Goebbels' point about using the truth comes into play, you have to be very careful as a propagandist not to lie so egregiously that the lies can then be exposed. Because once the lies are exposed, once people lose faith in a particular set of authorities, once the people see through a particular regime, and that regime loses what we call its credibility, it's finished. There is no way to get it back.
Now, the Creel Commission had a lot of help. It was also known as the Committee on Public Information. Creel organized all sorts of aspects of our media to support him, the films, newspapers, publication division. As you mentioned, famous writers would work for him. The advertising industry had a board supporting him. Why do important people seem to be very willing to volunteer for an enterprise like that?
Well, the whole media system jumped in quite enthusiastically to help out with this. People felt that it was their duty. There was a certain euphoria. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we know in our own time that the prospect of a righteous war really sets people on fire.
Walter Lippmann mentions that. He says, the citizen experiences a pleasurable emotion as he supports the foreign adventure.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen it in our own time. There are few feelings as, I don't know what to say, as overwhelming or as toxic as the feeling of committing oneself to a just national crusade.
And we all seem to enjoy the power, too. We join in it, even though we're not personally at risk.
You have a sense of power. You have a sense of impunity. You have a sense of righteous aggression. You have a sense of utter belonging. I mean, it's a brainless kind of an experience. You're surrendering your own reasoned mob, and it has the sanction of the whole establishment. It's quite something.
Creel also used front groups, like he had organizations called Friends of German Democracy and the League of Oppressed Nations. Why is a propagandist find those types of things useful?
Again, propaganda is that much more compelling when it seems not to be propaganda. If stuff comes directly from the government, it's going to be less impressive than stuff that seems to come from groups of citizens. Using front groups is a way to make the propaganda drive seem to come from everywhere. Everybody's on board.
You'd also mentioned censorship, and Lippmann said on that subject, without some form of censorship, propaganda is impossible. Is it necessary to have that backstop?
Well, yes. People often mistakenly use the word persuasion as a kind of synonym for propaganda. Propaganda is not persuasion. Persuasion involves argument. Persuasion involves dialogue. You and your adversary sort of hash it out. He or she has his or her counterarguments, and you address them, and you try to bring that person around to your way of thinking. Propaganda wants to obliterate. It wants all other points of view already to have been obliterated.
So it's fundamentally anti-democratic.
It's fundamentally anti-democratic. It's anti-rational. It wants not to persuade you. Rather, it wants to create a universe in which you would never even stop to think that there might be another way of looking at it. And this is exactly how state propaganda works. It does not want to engage in argument. It wants to create an entirely hermetic space where there is nothing but itself making its points over and over again. If you're allowed to hear from the other side, it's always the other side as concocted by the propagandists themselves. But no one can really break into this system. It's closed tight as a drum.
One of the most important propagandists to come out of World War I, perhaps the most important, was Edward Bernays. And in his book, Propaganda, originally published in 1928, Bernays wrote, quote, "Those who manipulate the masses constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. And propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government." Could you talk about that?
Bernays is very, very heavily influenced by Lippmann, but he had far less ambivalence. He had no ambivalence whatsoever about the craft of propaganda, whereas Lippmann was at least mindful of the objections on democratic grounds. Bernays called himself the father of public relations, and indeed, he was probably the foremost practitioner of commercial propaganda out there. This isn't just advertising per se. Bernays was a brilliant man who understood that you don't sell things directly, but rather figure out how to manipulate circumstances so that you create desires without specifically trumpeting the virtues of a particular product. Let me give you an example. He was hired by a piano company to help improve the sales of pianos. This is sometime in the 20s. Well, what he did was he actually made a successful effort to popularize the idea of adding music rooms to private homes. You know, he did this by working with people in architectural magazines and so on. Created a fad for music rooms. Well, once you have created that fad and people are eager to build music rooms, it's only natural that piano companies will benefit, and in particular the piano company that had hired Bernays, because they could then take advantage of that new architectural innovation, standing ready to provide pianos that will fit perfectly in with this new decor.
So he had the patience to come at the problem indirectly and
exactly.
to nurture the demand.
He came at the problem indirectly. And the book Propaganda is very impressive. It is not in any sense a detached analysis of propaganda. It is actually a kind of sales brochure for Bernays' own services.
Although he was basically a commercial person, one of the groups he represented was United Fruit, which got him involved in the 1954 CIA coup in Guatemala against Arbenz.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is where Bernays becomes extremely interesting. We spoke before about the difficulty of figuring out exactly how conscious the propagandist is of the spuriousness of his claims. Is he a self-conscious